2018 and reinstated its sanctions, prompting Iran to retaliate by scaling back its commitments to the JCPOA. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have been engaged in the Vienna talks to salvage the accord. The discussions envisage the removal of all sanctions against Iran in return for the country coming back to full compliance with the agreement.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions have not been an obstacle to its nuclear ambitions. At the same time, it wants to tell the JCPOA parties that Tehran will continue to develop its nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat. In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Romain Mazahari, Paris.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off the job and staged a nationwide strike demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses have been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten. About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany, and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years. A system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dezengov shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
In the limelight.
Militias are nothing new in the history of Zionism, says Amir Makul, writer, in an article published under the heading Palestinians in the Naqab Face New Threat from Zionist Far-Right Militia. Stay tuned for more. After months of deliberations involving the Zionist regime police, the Beersheba municipality, and the far-right Otzma Yehudit party, the Zionist regime recently saw the establishment of a Jewish militia bent on reclaiming the personal safety of the citizen. In the Zionist regime political lexicon, citizen is shorthand for Jewish Israeli. The newly formed militia is called Sayeret Barel, a nod to the Zionist regime Sayeret, or Special Forces, and to the Zionist sniper Barel Shamoli, who was fatally shot at the Gaza fence last summer. And this might only be the beginning, after the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett recently called on gun owners to arm themselves in the public. He said, "What is expected of you, Israeli citizens? Vigilance and responsibility. Whoever has a gun license, this is the time to carry a gun. We are also currently evaluating a larger framework to involve civilian volunteers who want to help and be of assistance." Unquote. The initiative dates back to October, when former Zionist regime police officer Almog Cohen announced plans to establish an armed militia to protect Jewish residents of the Naqab, due to what he baselessly claimed was inadequate police governance in the southern region. A call was put out for the registration of police volunteers who, according to the Zionist regime's media, were to undergo special training in one of the three brigades. One specialized in firearms, another in surveillance and security, and the third in logistics. Cohen said the group was formed because of the loss of sovereignty of the state and the personal security of the citizenry. His comments echoed the words of Beersheba's mayor, who has said if the regime would not carry out its duties, municipal militias would be required to restore security in the Naqab desert. These developments come in the wake of a string of violent incidents in the Naqab, which have fueled frustration among residents who say authorities are not doing enough to keep them safe. Ostensibly aiming to aid law enforcement, Cohen previously formed the Negev Rescue Committee, a far-right group that opposes the Arab-Palestinian presence in the Naqab. Shortly after announcing the formation of Sayeret Barrel, Cohen was asked whether he planned to take the law into his own hands, to which he responded, "We will not wait on any bureaucracy." The group was initially supported by the Zionist regime's police and municipal authorities, but after gaining attention in the media, the police withdrew their endorsement of the organization, saying that it would not be involved and did not attend the launch event that took place on March 20th, but officials have not said they will prevent the group's operation. Notably, the police attributed this move to the group's funding sources, saying that it was forbidden to crowdsource for such purposes. But on their website, members of the militia say they were establishing, with confirmation and collaboration of the police, the Barrel's force named after Barrel Shmuley. For its part, the Beersheba municipality criticized police for stating that the municipality had launched the group as a residential initiative made up of volunteers for the protection of personal safety, noting that police had offered the group both legitimacy and supervision. The question remains, why did Israeli regime police withdraw their support at the last possible moment over the crowdfunding issue? According to a police spokesperson quoted in Haaretz, the decision came after it was clarified that crowdsourcing for such purposes is forbidden. The spokesperson continued, "The police welcome citizens wishing to volunteer as long as this takes place according to police procedures. The crowdfunding in this case was done through a non-profit group that also raised money for the funding of former Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's trial." Militias are nothing new in the history of Zionism. In 1980s, one of the most prominent such groups, the Hamas-Teret, the Jewish Underground, carried out terrorist operations against Palestinian targets. In addition to attempting to assassinate Palestinian political figures, the Jewish Underground also plotted to blow up Al-Aqsa Mosque. What distinguishes Sayyid Barrel from such groups is its air of respectability and official backing. The municipality and police were complicit in its formation, even if they no longer support the group today. Palestinian rights groups and Knesset members should launch an investigation into the role of police in particular. During the uprising across historic Palestine last May, lynch mobs and terrorists targeted Arab neighborhoods, crimes that are typically treated leniently by the Zionist regime's so-called justice system. But the attacks were not limited to the far-right fringe, as the Zionist regime forces described the uprising as a new front that must be defended against in future, with the possibility of more intense violence ahead. In the case of Sayyid Barrel, the group's funding came through a crowdsourced campaign, which as of mid-March had reportedly raised 110,000 shekels, equally $34,000 of its target of 1.4 million shekels. At the end of the day, the formation of Sayyid Barrel and the fact that it has received official backing at various times and in various ways indicates that it is not just the product of individual fancy. A sophisticated organization is targeting Palestinians in the Naqab and across all of Palestine, and its leader has encouraged volunteers to be judge, jury, and executioner.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Systemic racism holding back black Americans. That is the assessment of a U.S. civil rights group, the National Urban League, who has said that the median household income for black people in the U.S. is 37% lower than that of white people. Why does racism in all of its forms, like in this case income, still persist in the U.S. to the extent that it does? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why it is difficult for people of color to overcome systemic racism in the U.S. in all of its forms.
An annual report by a New York-based civil rights organization has once again turned the spotlight on systemic racism and bias in the United States. The National Urban League's report showed that African Americans, despite making economic and health gains, still get just about 74% of what white people enjoy in the country. The organization demonstrates how difficult it is for people of color to overcome systemic racism.
These numbers change so little and so slowly. What it tells me is that this institutional disparity based on race seems to be built into American society.
The findings show the median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people and are less likely to benefit from home ownership. The report also touches upon educational gaps.
Black and white preschoolers are roughly equally prepared, but the classrooms they enter are starkly different. Schools with more minority students are more likely to have inexperienced, less trained, and even uncertified teachers. Fewer of these students are enrolled in the STEM classes that can lead to higher paying jobs. Black students are less likely to graduate from college.
On voting rights, the report says state legislatures have been restricting voting access in districts with large populations of black Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. The report also points to U.S. Justice Department statistics saying black people have been more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to experience threats or uses of force during police encounters and three times more likely to be jailed if arrested. The grim findings come nearly 2 years after the U.S. underwent a major reckoning on racism following the brutal killing of African-American George Floyd by a white police officer. His death ignited nationwide protests and demands for equality and end to police brutality against people of color. Nonetheless, the National Urban League's report has highlighted the fact that racial inequality in the U.S. is deep-rooted. It stems from years of injustice and institutionalized racism against African Americans and other minority groups, which worsened during Donald Trump's presidency. Anti-racism demonstrations have also failed to bring about any tangible change in previous years.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, who joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us, Joseph Richardson, professor of African American studies and anthropology at the University of Maryland from Laurel, Maryland.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Gerald Horn, let me first start with you. And I have to say, if you did not catch on, that this was a report by the civil rights group National Urban League. So obviously your opinion of that organization is very important. But basically, one of the conclusions it has reached is that systemic racism is holding back black Americans. And it says black people in the U.S. are trailing white people in critical areas. That includes wealth, education, social justice, health, and civic engagement. Are you surprised at that, first of all?
No, I'm not surprised. And those who are surprised have not been paying attention to U.S. history. That is to say, when the European settlers and colonists began invading in North America in the 1500s and 1600s, they set up a society that was exclusive. It was only tended to benefit those who were like themselves. they liquidated the indigenous population for the most part, and then handcuffed Africans and dragged them across the Atlantic to be slaves. And we have not been able to transcend that original sin, to the point where, as your reporter suggested, the prisons are overflowing with Black Americans. Black Americans are more likely to be subjected to the death penalty, that is to say, executed by the arm of the state. Black people are more likely to be shot down in the streets by the police forces. And with regard to housing discrimination, the latest revelation is that if a Black person is trying to sell their home, they find they can get more for their home if they take down the pictures on the walls of their Black relatives and leave the walls bare, or put up pictures of those who are defined as white. I can think of no worse example of the kind of white supremacy that obtains in the United States of America.
Joseph Richardson, you know, this National Urban League actually produced the first state of Black America in its report that, based on what it said, it captured the plight of the people who had been victims of systemic racism since arriving, as it said, in the shores of the U.S. And when you take a look at the year that report was published, it was back in 1976. Of course, Gerald Horn there goes back even further. When you have organizations like this and similar to this issuing out alarm bells and describing how this systemic racism is going on, and it's still, based on its most recent report, is even in some sense gotten worse, then why aren't there any action plans set forward, or have they, and it's just not working?
I believe that there have been action plans that have been set forward, and there are many scholars who have addressed the wealth gap in this country. We only need to look at the work of economist Sandy Darity at Duke University, who has been making the argument for reparations, and we've heard discussions and policies recommending and advocating for reparations across this nation. But if to hark back onto the work of Dr. Darity, found just in terms of the wealth gap in America, and it's quite interesting that we often emphasize the educational gaps, but what Dr. Darity found in terms of the differences in wealth is that white Americans, even those who have not graduated from high school and dropped out of high school, have greater wealth than Black Americans who have a college degree. And so his argument is that there really isn't a way to educate ourselves out of the great wealth gap and disparities that we have between Blacks and whites without having another form of remediation, and that would be in the form of reparations. Because as you mentioned, that report was made in 1976, and not much has changed in terms of Black wealth over the past 50 years. And in fact, we know that during the Obama administration, Black Americans actually lost more wealth because much of our wealth has been tied to home ownership. And so that intergenerational transference of wealth hasn't happened in the same way for Black Americans as it has traditionally benefited white Americans in this country.
One of the most alarming, at least in terms of what I saw, Gerald Horn, of this report, is how it talked about voting rights. And taking a look at the statement that it made there, it was very interesting in the way that it described it. And it said that it was actually an anti-democratic move that began after the 2008 election, when Black voting rates actually matched white voting rates for the first time, which catapulted Barack Obama into office. This sounds an awful lot like a UN report that recently came out talking about voting rights of minorities denied in parts of the U.S., mentioning Texas as one of those states. That sounds like Black voting is being, or Black votes are being suppressed. Is that what this is about, which is resulting in gerrymandering? And perhaps you can describe that for us.
Well, gerrymandering is the process whereby congressional districts or state legislative districts are drawn in such a way as to oftentimes dilute the effectiveness of the Black vote. That is normative, particularly in a state like Texas. You also need to realize that one of the reasons that this takes place is that the black voter tends to vote against conservatives, vote against the Republicans, vote against the right wing at a higher rate than any other demographic category, oftentimes reaching 9-1. And so it is in the material interest of the conservatives, of the Republicans, to try to dilute, if not obliterate, black voting power. If that were the only problem that we faced, of course, that would be formidable. But to return to the economic question, there is the question of employment discrimination. You've had recently attempts to pass laws, for example, to prevent employers from discriminating against people who have hair like mine. That is to say, it's quite usual, quite typical for black women to face discrimination because of having hair like this, a category that they have nothing to do with. That is the essence, obviously, of blatant discrimination. And the fact that you have to pass a law to address that says more than I could ever articulate.
Well, if you want to talk about the economy, this is definitely an eye-opener. And it's not new news. Joseph Richardson, I don't know if you're even aware of it. Hopefully you are, and perhaps you can spread the word. But there was one report that came out in 2020 by a major U.S. Banking group, Citigroup, that said the U.S. economy has lost $16 trillion because of discrimination. Now, this, again, it came out in 2020. There was another report that came out that was cited by the San Francisco Federal Reserve President Mary Daly that said that the racial and ethnic inequities have cost the U.S. economy some $51 trillion. Now, I do have to say, this is not just lost revenue from blacks, but also people of color. But still, it's a really large figure. You would think the U.S. government would address this, and I think at some point Joe Biden did address that in his presidential campaign, that he is aware of this.
Well, while President Biden may be aware of it, again, it takes the political will of our policymakers in order to implement and execute policies that will actually effectively address these issues. And so, again, I think what you're saying is has an historical context to it. The work of Lisa Cook, an economist at Michigan State, does some really rigorous scholarship in terms of black patents and the number of patents that have been stolen from black scientists and inventors, and what that has cost the U.S. economy, I think contributes in many respects to the number that you just noted. But we also have to think in terms of and the number of people that are not leaving, that are unable to get a college education, who can create and contribute to the economy by being scientists and incubators of innovation, and how that has impacted black Americans as well, in addition to preventing us from entering into small businesses by preventing us from getting loans. And we recently saw in Wells Fargo, just in terms of black wealth again, that far more black applicants were denied recently from getting home loans and particularly refinancing loans than white applicants. And so all of this in combination, whether it's the lack of our being able to build our human capital, which ultimately may tie into our social and financial capital, plays an instrumental role in accumulating our wealth. And so the statistics that you just noted, I don't find them surprising at all, understanding and knowing the context of the way structural racism has played out in terms of even the scientists and innovation in terms of patents among black people in this country.
Sure. And of course, Gerald Horn, I do have to say that this is not something that the U.S. is just the U.S. experiencing, but also a phenomenon around the world. When this report was described, Gerald Horn, it said, in different, mind you, websites, it said that the report came nearly 2 years after the U.S. experienced what it called a major reckoning on racism in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd. Now, we know that this type of racism has existed before. Do you agree, or why do you think the reason is that the report, or the description of the report, is stated as such, that it comes after what it calls a major reckoning? After the death of George Floyd, or the killing of George Floyd?
Well, I would say that it was a reckoning. I'm not so sure it was a major reckoning, because if it was a major reckoning, we would not be discussing the dismal report that's now on our agenda. For those who may not recall, in May 2020, the black man known as George Floyd was executed on tape by police officers in the state of Minnesota. That led to mass protests across the country and indeed in many parts of the world. That is the so-called major reckoning that took place. But it takes more, I'm afraid to say, than a spate of demonstrations to erode the encrusted bigotry that has accumulated over the decades and over the centuries in the United States of America. And in fact, I dare say that given the fact that inflation is now racking the U.S. economy, and indeed the economies of a goodly number of advanced capitalist countries, you can expect these kinds of dismal reports to be issued regularly. Because when there are economic downturns, oftentimes the rate and regularity of racism accelerates. And I'm afraid to say that that's maybe on the agenda as we speak.
Well, it's very alarming, I would think, Joseph Richardson, when you take a look at what the report has said regarding representation in Congress. And it said people of color made up 90% of the population growth in North Carolina, 95% of the population growth in Texas, yet the communities of color in those states have seen decreased representation in Congress. Now, if I'm in the White House and I'm reading this, I should be alarmed, because what if this were to spread to more states? Because as this report indicated, for example, you have a major increase in the number of populations that are the spending that occurs from consumers, and at the same time, you have, for example, incomes that are 37% less than that of white people, as is said, for black people. My question being, there needs to be an equality of some sorts to be applied here, whether it's a representation in Congress, income, and what have you. Do you see any major movements to that effect?
No, but I would say that we have not had the same level of representation in Congress that was reflective of the black population since Reconstruction. We had far more senators and congressmen that were of African-American descent in Congress during Reconstruction than we've had since then. So, I mean, there's a historical context to this, which isn't just playing out recently. I mean, we're talking about well over 100 years. So, and just in terms of, we need to think about in terms of who we are voting for. How are we casting our vote? Dr. Horn mentioned that we typically vote against conservatives, but we also have to revisit, just in terms of our own economic health and survival, what has the Democratic Party done to deliver our vote? And we have several scholars that have made the argument that maybe African Americans should form more of a voting bloc than to just freely give their vote over to the Democratic Party, because it hasn't resulted in any kind of economic advancement for Black Americans, whether in terms of economically or even in terms of our civil rights agenda. And so, again, I think we need to retrench and think more critically about what has the Democratic Party done for Black Americans in terms of advancing our economics, advancing the health of our communities, our life expectancy, and the educational systems, as well as the criminal justice system, which we haven't seen many gains for African Americans, regardless of what party we choose to elect and place into office. And so maybe it is time for us to think about how we can leverage our vote in terms of leveraging our vote with who needs our vote the most in terms of what we will get out of it and in terms of placing it, specific candidates in office and not thinking specifically along party lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gerald Horn, what do you think about that? At this point, do you see the Democratic Party failing in delivering on its promises, especially when it comes to either people of color or African Americans or blacks? Or do you see that the Democratic Party is not doing that, and therefore there needs to be another kind of representation for, and I'm going to put people of color as a whole, and then blacks or African Americans specifically?
Well, I would like to add another factor, which is that if you look historically, the crucial and critical factor that helps to propel black people in particular forward has been the global context. It's no accident that U.S. apartheid, legalized discrimination and racism, begins to retreat 70-odd years ago when the United States is under international pressure as African and Caribbean nations are coming to independence and the socialist camp is bidding for influence amongst those nations. The U.S. decides that the better part of wisdom is to try to execute an agonizing retreat away from the more egregious and horrible aspects of Jim Crow. I agree that left to its own devices, the road ahead for black people will be quite rocky. But that's where our international allies, particularly our allies and friends in Iran, can intervene, because just as our friends in Iran are under pressure from Washington and from the right wing and from those who rule the United States, black people are under pressure from the right wing as well. So I would urge our friends overseas, not least in Iran, to speak out on our behalf, because that would be in your interest and that would be in our interest.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. We appreciate that. Gerald Horn, Professor of History and African American Studies from the University of Houston. Thank you so much. Joseph Richardson, thank you. Professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatwe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump and two of his children had sought to block New York Attorney General Letitia James from interviewing them under oath. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Jonah Bromwich, Ben Protest, and William Rashbaum. The piece is titled "New York Attorney General Can Question Trump and Two Children, Judge Rules." Stay with us for more. The New York Attorney General can question Donald J. Trump and two of his adult children under oath as part of a civil inquiry into his business practices. A judge ruled on Thursday, 17th of February, the latest in a string of legal defeats Donald Trump has suffered since leaving office. The ruling came just 3 days after a court filing by the Attorney General Letitia James in the same matter revealed that Mr. Trump's long-time accounting firm had cut ties with him and had essentially retracted a decade's worth of his financial statements. Letitia James's inquiry and a parallel criminal investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney are both examining whether Donald Trump used those statements to improperly inflate the value of his assets so he could receive favorable loans. Lawyers for the Trump family had sought to prohibit Letitia James, a Democrat, from interviewing Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump. They had argued that Ms. James was politically biased against Donald Trump and was inappropriately using her civil inquiry to aid the district attorney's criminal investigation, which she's also participating in. But in a written ruling, the judge, Arthur N. Goron, dismissed that point, saying it completely misses the mark. After dismantling several other arguments, he concluded that Ms. James had uncovered copious evidence of possible financial fraud, evidence that entitled her to question the Trump family. She has the clear right to do so, the judge wrote, ordering that Mr. Trump and his son and daughter face questioning in the next 3 weeks. Thursday's ruling was the latest in a notable legal losing streak for Donald Trump, which has included several rebukes from the United States Supreme Court. Since he left office, Mr. Trump has lost the battle to withhold his financial records from the Manhattan District Attorney, to block a congressional committee from inspecting his White House records as part of an investigation into the 6th of January attack on the Capitol, and to appeal the results of the 2020 presidential election. For Mr. Trump, the fallout from some of these decisions could be significant, exposing him to civil and criminal liability, as he has come under investigation from at least three prosecutors, in addition to Letitia James. Not only are the authorities in New York scrutinizing Mr. Trump, the district attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, has convened a grand jury as part of an investigation into the former president's attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election results in Georgia. Today, justice prevailed, Letitia James said in a statement, adding, "No one is above the law." In a rambling statement released on Thursday evening, 17th of February, Donald Trump blasted the decision and attacked Letitia James, Hillary Clinton, and the media. "It is a continuation of the greatest witch hunt in history," he said, adding, "I can't get a fair hearing in New York because of the hatred of me by judges and the judiciary." He has previously denied all wrongdoing. "The entire system is corrupt," a spokeswoman for the Trump Organization said. The ruling does not mean that Letitia James will automatically receive the answers that she's seeking. Donald Trump and his children can invoke their constitutional right not to incriminate themselves, as Mr. Trump's other adult son, Eric Trump, did when questioned by the Attorney General's office back in October of 2020. The Trump family also intends to appeal the decision, according to the spokeswoman. The judge's decision followed a fiery virtual hearing in State Supreme Court in Manhattan on Thursday, during which lawyers for Mr. Trump and the Attorney General made their cases. Several times, Mr. Trump's lawyers became so heated that Justice Engoron and his law clerk had to call for a timeout, raising their hands in the shape of a T, a gesture more often seen at a sporting event than in a courtroom. Although Letitia James signaled in court papers that she had amassed significant evidence against Donald Trump's family business, she has accused the Trump Organization of engaging in fraudulent or misleading practices. She has said that she needs to question Donald Trump and his children before determining her next move. Mr. Trump and his children sought to block the questioning, and Letitia James responded in a court filing last month, arguing that there was heightened need for testimony from the three family members. She said that by questioning them, she would be able to determine who was responsible for the misstatements and omissions that the company made in its financial documents. Because Letitia James's inquiry is civil, she cannot bring criminal charges. If she finds evidence of wrongdoing, she can file a lawsuit against Mr. Trump, his company, or others involved in the business. In last month's filing, Letitia James said that her lawyers had not yet reached a final decision on a lawsuit, but argued that the grounds for conducting the investigation are beyond reproach. On Monday, 14th of February, Letitia James released a letter in which Mr. Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, declared that Mr. Trump's financial statements from 2011 to 2020 were not reliable. Mr. Trump provided those financial statements, which include various disclaimers noting that they are unaudited, to his lenders, and at least to one insurance company. They are central to both the civil and criminal inquiries into Donald Trump. Mazars USA said in a letter that it had not, as a whole, found material discrepancies between the information the Trump Organization provided and the actual value of Mr. Trump's assets, something that Mr. Trump's lawyers asserted had effectively rendered the civil and criminal investigations moot. But Justice Engoron scoffed at the argument, likening it to the dystopian slogans like "War is peace" in George Orwell's 1984, to Lewis Carroll's inverse meanings in Through the Looking Glass, and to the former senior Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway's Alternative Facts, suggesting that the Mazars' red flag warning about the financial statements made the investigations moot, the judge wrote, is as audacious as it is preposterous. The criminal investigation, which is similarly focused on whether Donald Trump used those statements to mislead his lenders about the value of his hotels, golf clubs, and other properties, is being led by Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan District Attorney who inherited it when he took office in January. Last year, under Alvin Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus Vance Jr., Manhattan prosecutors separately indicted the Trump Organization and its longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, accusing them of conducting a years-long scheme to evade taxes by compensating employees with special off-the-books benefits such as apartment rentals and luxury cars. Mr. Trump's lawyers said that the criminal inquiry, which also involves investigators from Letitia James's office, would improperly benefit if the Attorney General's office questioned Mr. Trump and his children in the civil inquiry. They argued that Letitia James would be able to obtain information that would be valuable to the criminal investigation without having to provide the family members the immunity that they would receive were they to testify in front of a criminal grand jury. Under New York law, witnesses who appear before the grand jury receive immunity from prosecution on the subject of their testimony. After maintaining a neutral posture during the hearing, Justice Engoron was blunt in his ruling, which also directed the former president to provide the Attorney General with documents she sought in her subpoena. Addressing the argument that Letitia James was improperly using the civil investigation to bolster the criminal inquiry, he noted that the Trumps had not been asked to appear before a grand jury. He was also unconvinced by the argument that Letitia James was politically biased, which Mr. Trump's lawyers advanced by citing statements that the Attorney General had made while campaigning, including her promise to use every area of the law to investigate Mr. Trump, who was then still in office. Justice Engoron said that Letitia James had the right to say whatever she liked about Mr. Trump while running for office, and that there was a clear basis for her investigation.